We found this morning that the Colossians had faith in Christ, and they had love for all the saints. They had hope laid up for them in heaven. They're excited about that. They had a good place to meet in Philemon's house. They had a good pastor in Epaphroditus. But they were spiritual babies. And so Paul was praying for them, began praying for them, when all those things were already true, because he wanted to see them really growing up into Christ. And his prayer, as we said, takes the form of a tree. Let's just read through the tree bit. That's from verse 9. For this reason, since the day we heard about you, we've not stopped praying for you and asking God to fill you with the knowledge of his will through all spiritual wisdom and understanding. And we said that was the root, that you might be filled with the knowledge of God's will. Then the tree coming out of that, we pray this in order that you may live a life worthy of the Lord and may please him in every way. That's the tree trunk. Then the four branches, bearing fruit in every good work, that's one, growing in the knowledge of God, two, being strengthened with all power according to his glorious might, three, and verse 12, giving thanks to the Father who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of the saints in the kingdom of light. That's the fourth branch. So we're going to look at the tree trunk this evening. We pray this in order that you may live a life worthy of the Lord and may please him in every way. And it might be a healthy exercise if we each asked ourselves just now, how much pleasure has God got out of his relationship with me today and out of my response to him today? Is that in any way fitting when you think of the trouble he went to put us here, to make us, to organize for us sunshine and fresh air and friends and food and clothing, etc. And when he paid what he did for us in giving his son to die for us, how much of a return has he got out of his relationship with you today? And he says, does it really matter? Well, Paul says he wants us to live a life worthy of the Lord and please him in every way. And you may be familiar with the verse in Revelation that says, thou art worthy because thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure they are created. You were not created to please yourself. You were not created, first of all, to please anybody else except him. That was his proposition in putting you here, that you would please him. And life does not make sense when you don't live it on the terms for which you are given it. You can get by, but it will never make sense, and it will never be the beautiful thing it could be. Just to give you a silly illustration, suppose I was heard to grumble about the price of gas for my car with great frequency. So the little boy next door, who happens to be 3 years old, hears his Uncle Ken grumbling about the price of gas for his car, and he thinks he'll do something nice for me. And so when I'm out, he takes my keys off the hook, and he goes to my car and he drives it down to the filling station, and he drives past the three different standards of gas they have there, and he thinks to himself they are kind of expensive. And then he finds another little pump that's separate from all the rest, where they sell kerosene. And he looks at the price of kerosene, and he finds that kerosene is actually a lot less expensive than gas. So he fills my car up with kerosene, and then he discovers that he can't get it back home again. So he leaves it there, but he brings the keys back, and he gives me the keys, and he says, Uncle Ken, your car is down at the filling station, and there's a surprise for you. So I go down, and I find my car there, and I remember that the gas tank was pretty well empty, but I get in, and I put the keys in, and turn on the ignition. The needle goes all the way up to 4. Hey, filled my gas tank. Isn't that great? And I try and start it. It won't start. I try again, and it won't start. I try again, and it won't start. about the 18th try, it kind of coughs and splutters into life. And I try to drive it home, and it goes like a kangaroo with hiccups. And the clouds of black smoke coming out the back, and all the plants die within the range of about 20 yards. And the huge sparks shooting out of the exhaust. And it's going, but it's not going very well. Why is that? Because it's not being used the way it was designed to be used. Similarly, but not actually the way it was designed to be used. And if I don't use it the way it was designed to be used, it doesn't go very well. The same is true of your life. If you use it for any other purpose than that for which it was originally created, it doesn't work too well. And you were designed to bring pleasure to your designer. You were created to please God. Now, when an artist sets out to do a work of art, he usually does two things. One thing that he does is he copies what is already there. The other thing that he does is he puts into it some of his own personal ability and expertise and vision as an artist. So if you think that you're sufficiently good-looking, wealthy and famous that you should have your portrait painted, and you commission somebody to paint your portrait, you hope that they will do both of those things, that they will copy what is already there and they will express their own artistic talent. So they'll copy what's there and the painting will actually look like you, otherwise you might as well get somebody else's. And you hope that it will also be a real work of art, otherwise you might as well have a photograph. But when God set off about his great work of art, that we call a creation, he only did one of those two things. He did not copy what was already there for a very good reason. What was a very good reason that he didn't copy what was already there? Right, there was nothing there to copy. So he did the other thing, he expressed himself. Okay. That is why with everything that he made, when he stood and looked at it, he said, hey, that's good. Because God uses words very carefully. We use them very loosely, he uses them very carefully. See, for instance, I know a man who has a good time, he tells me, beating up his wife. Okay. Now, he does not have a good time beating up his wife. What he means is he has an enjoyable time beating up his wife. The fact that he enjoys it doesn't make it good. I know other people who tell me they have a good time getting drunk. And maybe they do enjoy it, but that doesn't make it good. A lawyer once came to Jesus and said, good master, and Jesus said, hold it, right there. Who are you calling good? Don't you know there's only one who's good? That's God. Is that what you mean? And the standard of good is God himself. And something's only good if it's like God. If it's not like God, it's not good. It may be popular and it may be enjoyable, but that doesn't make it good. And God is the standard of anything being good or not being good. So he began to create things, and he had a look at everything he created, and he said, hey, that's good. What do you mean? It's like himself. And so he created the stars, and they expressed something about God. Created the oceans, and they portrayed something else about God. Created the mountains, and they told us yet something else about God. And everything he made, he said, hey, that's good. Until he made the man and the woman together, and then looked at them, and he said, that is very good. And now we have a problem. If something can only be good if it's like God, how can anything ever be very good? Well, the mountain told us one thing about God, and the sun told us something else, the stars told us something else. The tree told us something else, but the man and the woman together were designed to tell everything about God. So if you wanted to know what God was like, all you'd have to do is watch the man and the woman together behaving, and you'd have a perfect picture of God himself. His wisdom, his gentleness, his truth, his purity, his love, his strength, his everything about God you would see in the behavior of those two together. That's very good. The only trouble is, I get to about page 3 of my Bible, and I don't find God saying, that is very good. I read on page 3 of my Bible that God said, yuck! Now, you may think that is very undignified of God to say anything like that. In fact, you may think that God only speaks in early 17th century English, because there are people who believe that. God only speaks in early 17th century English. So if he does, then he didn't say yuck. It goes more like this. God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually, and God said, it repenteth me that I have created man, I will now destroy man from off the face of the earth. But I didn't think we had time to say that, and yuck sort of sums it up. And if you think that God would never say such a terrible thing, in Revelation chapter 3, there is a church in Laodicea, which is neither hot nor cold. And Jesus says of that church, because you're not hot and you're not cold, I will spew thee out of my mouth. Still using early 17th century English. I will spew thee out of my mouth. How would you paraphrase, I would spew thee out of my mouth, other than, yuck! So if you think that he wouldn't say anything quite that undignified, it's probably more on your account than on his. He's more interested in accuracy than he is in nicety sometimes. So God looked at the earth and he said, yeah, what a disgusting mess. I'm going to destroy man from off the face of the earth. Only Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord and he landed high and dry. And the human race continued through Noah. And through Noah, he chose the family of one man, that is Abraham. And through Abraham's family, one man, his grandson, Jacob, who got his name changed to what? Israel. And through Israel, then we have a whole nation called Israel. And they're chosen out of all the earth to do two things. To one, to know what God is like. And two, show what he's like. Okay? And that's what they're chosen for, to know what he's like and to show what he's like. And they're given three advantages. They are rules, religion, and riches. The rules are the Ten Commandments and the moral law. And they're designed, first of all, so that they would know what God is like. See, the rules are actually God's character spelt out in terms of human behavior. God, for instance, is faithful. If he was a man, he would not be an adulterer. So the law says you must not commit adultery. What's wrong with adultery if it's popular as it is and it's enjoyable as I'm prepared to believe? It's not like God because God's faithful. And we're supposed to be like God. So it'll never be right. Never be good. God is a God of integrity. If he was a man, he would not be a thief. So the law says, you must not steal. What's wrong with stealing? It's not like God. He's not a thief. So the law is the character of God expressed in human behavior. Now, by studying the law and being well acquainted with it, seeing what it says, they would know what God is like. He's like his law. By keeping the law, they would show what kind of a God they had. And the rest of the world could tell what kind of a person God is from watching the behavior of his people Israel. So they would know what he was like, and they would show what he was like. Then he gave them religion. Suppose that you've been living back then when they lived in the desert. And there is born to the old cow that your dad has a beautiful little white calf. Baby cow, we're communicating. I don't say that the same way as you would. Calf is actually the way to say it. And this beautiful little white calf is born. And you can hardly believe your good fortune when your dad says to you, that calf is your responsibility. You are to look after it, make sure it gets plenty to drink, sufficient to eat, gets tethered at night so it can't get lost, doesn't get left out too long in the hot sun, your responsibility. And you're really excited, and you give your little calf a name, and you look after it, and it learns to come when you call its name, and you're getting on quite well with it, when one day your dad comes home, he's looking very serious, and he says, put a rope on the calf. And you say, why? Where are we going? Church. Church. My calf doesn't go to church. Doesn't know any choruses. Haven't taught it to pray. But your dad is looking very solemn, and you stop arguing, put a rope on the calf, and you take it to church. It's a kind of big tent out in the desert called the tabernacle. And you tie it up to the altar outside, huge brass altar, and out comes the high priest looking very impressive, and this big gold crown and all the other bits of his apparatus that he wore. And he comes out, and your dad puts his hand on the head of the calf, and he confesses having stolen something that day. And you can hardly believe it. Your dad's stealing. It's awful. And the priest takes it very seriously, and your dad takes it very seriously. And when your dad is finished, the priest takes a sharp knife and slits the throat of your calf. And the blood bursts out of the arteries, and the priest catches it in the basin. And right in front of your eyes, your little calf dies, your beautiful little white calf that you got so fond of. And when it's dead, the priest takes the blood and he sprinkles it 7 times on your dad, and he tells him that God has taken the life of this calf in exchange for his life. And he goes free because the calf has died. And you've learned a whole lot through this bit of religion about God. You've known that he's a God who sees personal sin and regards it as being serious. You've learned that he's a God who wants to make a way for men to be forgiven so they can know they're forgiven. And you see the reality of forgiveness in your dad as his head comes back up again, his shoulders are squared away, and he's not furtive and sort of cowed anymore. He's bold and confident again. And on your way home, you say, Dad, I understand that. I realize that sin is serious and that it must be paid for, but that there is forgiveness and it's beautiful. I see all that. But why did it have to be my little calf? I mean, such a beautiful animal, and it was young and it was innocent. Why didn't we bring the old cow? Because she's going to die anyway. And your dad explains how only that which is perfect is good enough for God. And you've learned a whole lot about God, what he's like, through your religion. And by studying their religion, they would know what he was like. By observing it, they would demonstrate, show what he was like all the time. And then the riches, that was the land of Canaan, the land flowing with milk and honey. So, of course, they needed rubber boots because it was very wet and sticky everywhere they went. But really, it was just a land that was beautifully productive. And it had everything they could possibly need in it. And all they had to do with that was enjoy it. And they would know that God is a God who loves to supply our needs in abundance. He really does. He enjoys blessing his people. And by thinking about that, they would know what God was like. By enjoying those riches, they would show what he's like. So they had 3 advantages. Rules, the moral law, religion, and riches. But after a little while, God took a look at the nation of Israel, and he looked at them and he said, yuck! What a disgusting mess. Destroy Israel. Actually, he told them a little story about a farmer who had a vineyard, and he was looking forward at harvest time to some nice, big, fat, sweet, juicy grapes. Because he liked grapes, and he liked grape jelly, and he enjoyed grape juice, and he liked his wine. So he's looking forward to all this, but although he'd done everything he could think of, he bought a really good field, faced south, it had lots of sun. He dug it over, got all the rocks out of it, built a wall around it so animals couldn't wander through, dug a well so there'd always be water even in the driest time of year, and bought the most expensive plant he could find, and tilled the soil, fertilized it, etc. Waited for his harvest, looking forward to these big, fat, sweet, juicy grapes. But instead of getting these beautiful, big, fat grapes, what he got was little wild grapes. Horrible, sour things. And you take a bite of one of those wild grapes, and they're so sour, your eyes start to water, and you swallow your cheeks. And you can't take another bite, and your teeth are set on edge. And they're useless, can't do anything with them, can't drink the juice, can't make jelly, can't do anything with them, just throw them away. And then he says, why? Why, when I did everything right and I paid all this for this vine and I fertilized the soil and I built the wall and I built the well, why, when I wanted these nice, big, fat, sweet grapes, have I got these horrible, miserable, sour little things? Well, the answer must be that the vine's no good, must destroy the vine. Start all over again. And then he goes on to say this, the vine is the house of Judah. And I did everything I could for you, Judah. I gave you rules, religion, riches. When you began to wander from my ways, I sent my prophets to call you back to my ways, but you wouldn't come. And I look for a harvest of my character reproduced in you. Of my purity and truth and love being reproduced in you. But instead of that, what I get is violence and oppression and hatred and lying and corruption. And there's only one answer to it. The vine is no good. Destroy the vine. Israel is no good. Destroy Israel. But then there stood one person who said a kind of an amazing thing. He said, I am the true vine. Who's that? Who said, I am the true vine? Jesus. What did he mean when he said, I am the true vine? This is what he meant. I am everything that my nation failed to be. My whole nation miserably failed in spite of all that God did for them. So in spite of all the advantages my father gave to you, you failed, but I succeed. And I succeed where the whole country has failed. And now when people make extravagant claims about themselves, we don't always believe them, do we? Do you believe people when they make extravagant claims about themselves, like politicians and salesmen, those kind of people? Reminds me of my favorite story, which is about the Prince of Wales. Not the present Prince of Wales, but an earlier one. And when he was a teenager, he was in St. James's Park in London with his friend, the Duke of Kent. And life was kind of boring, and they were looking for some amusement when they saw a London policeman with a nice, big, pointed blue helmet that all London policemen wear, because they have heads that shape too. So they saw the policeman, his big helmet, and they were just saying to each other, wouldn't it be fun to knock that helmet off his head? When into the park, there came a scruffy little boy from obviously a very poor home. He was about 9 years old, very small, with mud everywhere and rips in his shirts and tatty pants, but swinging a slingshot. So they beckoned him over and they showed him a nice bright coin. They said, that's yours if you can knock off that helmet. It's easy, he said. Looked around, found a stone, put it into his slingshot, took aim, and it was a superb shot. And the helmet went flying off the policeman's head and landed with a splash in a puddle. And the Prince of Wales and the Duke of Kent stood there rocking with laughter together with their little friend from the streets of London when they discovered that there is actually more than one policeman in London, because another one had come up behind them and seen the whole thing, and he was not pleased. And he walked up to them and he took out his notebook and he looked at the first one and he said, what is your name? See, and he looked up at the policeman and he said, I, Constable, am the Prince of Wales. Now the policeman was used to meeting Superman and Donald Duck and all kinds of interesting characters during the course of his duties, and he wasn't about to be taken in by this one. So he gave him a long, hard, cold, searching stare. Finally decided it actually could be the Prince of Wales at that. So he wrote down into his notebook, Prince of Wales. They looked at the next one and he said, and who are you? See, and he said, I, Constable, am the Duke of Kent. So he got a long, hard, cold look too. And then down into the book goes the Duke of Kent. Then turns to a scruffy little 9-year-old and says, and who are you? And he winked at the other two as though to say, I understand this game you're playing. I have played it many times myself, and you don't need to be alarmed. I understand the rules very well. And he looked up at the policeman. He said, what, me, officer? I'm the Archbishop of Canterbury. And being a highly intelligent policeman, he looked at him again and thought, he doesn't look like the Archbishop of Canterbury. See? And this may be our reaction to this man Jesus when he says that he is everything that the whole nation of Judah had failed to be. I am the true vine, he said, and they were the false vine. So let us check him out. When he was born, there was a big star in the sky, and we told you what that was about. What was that about? It was God's birth announcement. See, you may have had through the mail a little card with a picture of a stork on the front, flapping along, and suspended from its beak was a big bouncing baby bundle. And it's from these friends of yours, and they're telling you that their baby has arrived. Sigismund was born at 3 a.m. on the 34th of February, 1994, weighing in 3 tons, 6.5 ounces, measuring 4 feet long by 2 inches wide. Please send your gift to the address below. And they're announcing their birth to you. That's what God is doing, this big star in the sky. God was excited about the birth of his son. And he wanted everybody to know, and everybody wanted to know, could find out from the star. God was excited about it. And he sent a singing telegram with the angels to tell the shepherds. And God is celebrating the birth of his son. But he didn't just stay a newborn baby. Some years ago, I was in California, staying with some friends who had a small apartment near San Francisco. And they just had 2 bedrooms, theirs, and one belonging to Matthew, their little son, who was 18 months old. And they moved Matthew out of his room so that I might occupy it. And here I was in Matthew's room. They also took his cot out of there and put a bed in for me, which was very nice of them. And as I looked around, one of the things I noticed was a calendar on the wall, and it was about this size. This is how I knew it was California, almost 6 feet long, with a square for every day of the year. And along the top it said, Matthew's first year of life. And there was something written in every square for every single day of Matthew's first year of life. And they'd coloured in the squares in different colours too. Some of them just one colour, others psychedelic. So there was the first square, Matthew was born. A few days later, Matthew came home from the hospital. A few days later, Matthew said, gah, gah, gah. Days later, Matthew puked on daddy's trousers, etc. And as I looked at this calendar with my penetrating intelligence, I said to myself, these people are interested in Matthew's development. And they were, to say the least. And they were doting parents, but they had 2 limitations. Here was 1 limitation. They couldn't watch all the time. They had to go to sleep sometimes. And they missed things while they were asleep. And the husband went out to work occasionally. And he missed things while he was out at work. But his wife filled him in on the details when he got home again. But they were doting parents. But they couldn't watch all the time. They missed some things. God does not have that difficulty. He can and he does watch 24 hours a day. 60 seconds every minute. Doesn't miss anything. What is you? Was his son Jesus growing up. Then there was another limitation that they had, and I could understand this one. My wife and I have brought three children into the world, and all babies, all newborn babies, look like prunes. They're all wrinkled. See? And as I hinted to you the other day, there are two ends to a prune. There is one end out of which comes the most irritating noise known to man. That's to tell you the prune is hungry, and you attend to that end with a bottle of milk. And they need feeding at one end, and they have no sense of responsibility at the other end. And when our first prune was 3 weeks old, I was left in charge of it for a short space of time. So my wife went out, and the prune began to scream. So I went over and I picked up the prune. Continued to scream with great show of confidence that I didn't altogether feel. I picked up a bottle and stuck it in the screaming end. The bottle was spat out, so I pushed it back in again a little more firmly, and it was pushed out again even more firmly. And I said to myself, the problem is not at that end. So with great reluctance, I examined the other end, only to find there was no problem there either. That was the limit of my expertise as far as prunes were concerned, but this one was still screaming. So I talked to it and I said, "Why are you screaming, prune?" The answer to which was an even louder scream, and I knew that there was something wrong, apparently quite seriously wrong, but I didn't know what it was. I could tell from the outside that there was something wrong with it, but I could only see the outside, and I couldn't see the inside. I didn't know what was wrong. And all human parents have that limitation. You can only see the outside. But God can see the inside as well as the outside. And he watches you 24 hours a day, doesn't miss anything, inside and outside. Not only does he watch you like that, he watched his little son Jesus like that, inside and outside. And he did something very difficult for a parent. He said nothing out loud for 30 years. He watched his son growing up but said nothing to anybody else. See, he watched him, for instance, when the first time Jesus' father said to him, "Jesus, no, don't do that." And he saw Jesus' reaction as a little boy to authority. And he said to himself, "Hey, that's good." And then he saw when Jesus' brothers and sisters were born, and they were a poor family, and the brothers and sisters began to compete for the very limited amount of food and toys, etc., that there were for them, and compete for mum and dad's attention. And he saw how Jesus responded to the competition of his younger brothers and sisters. He said to himself, "That's good." Remember, God's only saying something's good if it's just like himself. And then he watched as his little son made friends with other people, and they told lies. And he could see right into the heart of Jesus when he discovered that his friends were telling lies, and how convenient it is sometimes. And he saw the response of Jesus to that whole scene. He said, "That's good." He could see right into the very heart of his son when he began to understand the real difference between boys and girls. And he said, "Hey, that's good." All the way through his teen years and his growing up years and his young manhood, single state to the age of 30. And he said to himself, "That's good. That's great." And then he saw as his son had to learn the trade of a carpenter and to do business in carpentry and make that little family business pay with Jews and Arabs and Romans and haggle for money. And he saw his son's attitude to all these things. Hey, that's good. And for 30 years he watched and just talked to himself, said nothing out loud. At the age of 30, Jesus was baptized, and the baptism was for sinners who were turning away from their sin. And people watching Jesus getting baptized would be likely to say, he must be a sinner or else he wouldn't need to be baptized. And the father wasn't having that at any price, so he kind of tore the clouds apart and he said, hey, that is my son in whom I am well pleased. That's amazing. Because God looked at mankind at the beginning and he said, yuck. And he looked at Israel and he said, yuck. And now he looks at Jesus and he says, hey, I'm pleased. The first man who has ever pleased me. The first human being who has ever lived a life that's pleasing to me. From that time on, the Father keeps on endorsing the identity of Jesus. On the Mount of Transfiguration, that's my son. To Peter, who do you say I am? You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. Oh, come on, Peter. You didn't work that out for yourself. I know you didn't. You're too thick. My father told you, didn't he? He just can't stop telling people who I am. He's proud of me. And as he was dying on the cross, the centurion, amazed at his behavior, wonders, how can you account for this? And the father told him, that's my son. And just as Jesus died, the centurion said, surely this was a righteous man, surely this was the Son of God. If Peter couldn't work it out, neither could the centurion. It takes God to show you who Jesus is. And the Father keeps on identifying Jesus as his son from the moment of his baptism on through his 3 years of public ministry. And after his death even. Now, as the Father looked at Jesus, he was pleased. And he could examine Jesus 24 hours a day, inside and out, and he did. But not only that, he examines you 24 hours a day, inside and out. He's been looking at me every second I've been living today. Now, what do you suppose that God the Father has been looking for as he's been looking at me every second I've lived today? It's very simple. What he's been looking for is Jesus. Because Jesus is the only human being who ever pleased God. Mankind couldn't do it at the beginning. Israel couldn't do it with all their advantages. You can't do it, and I can't do it. The only person who can please the Father is Jesus. That is why the only life that will ever please God is the Christian life, lived by Christ himself in his people. And when Paul says here that you are to be filled with the knowledge of his will through all spiritual wisdom and understanding, we pray this in order that you may live a life worthy of the Lord and may please him in every way. The only possibility of your pleasing him at all is if it's Jesus who's living in you. So if it's Ken Needham living, then the Father looks at me and he says, yuck! What a disgusting mess. That's Ken Needham. I've seen more than enough of him. I wish he'd get out of the way. Or else he looks at me and if it's Jesus who's living, then he says, hey, that's Jesus. That's great. That's my son. That's good. And what is the Father's will for you? Here is one, that in everything, he, that is Jesus, might have the preeminence. the place of first importance. That in everything, Jesus will be preeminent in your life. That's the Father's will for you. And if that's the root, and the root is that Jesus is preeminent in everything, then the tree trunk is a lifestyle which is Jesus living through you. And if it's Jesus living through you, then it is a lifestyle worthy of him, pleasing him in every way. But that's the only possibility. So let me ask you, who's been living today? Has it been you or has it been Jesus? What has God been saying? Has been saying, yuck, or hey, that's great. There are two other little things that it's worth bearing in mind. See, because you're a son of God, God has sent the Spirit of his Son into your heart, crying, Abba, which means Father. When you became a Christian, the Spirit of Jesus came to live in you. And the Spirit of Jesus recognizes God the Father, as Father. Now, if that Spirit is really let loose in you, if he's really living in you and through you, he looks back at God and he says, hey, Dad! Good to see you, Dad. And there is a great upsurge from within of confidence and assurance. I know that I am a son of God because his Spirit bears witness with my spirit that I am a child of God. If, on the other hand, I've scrunched his spirit up and thrust him into the back of my life so that I can get on and do my thing and please myself, then I have no assurance that I'm a Christian, no assurance that God even exists, and I kind of wander around thinking, I hope this is true, I hope I'm a Christian, well, I'd like to think I'm going to heaven. I'm not very sure. Maybe I'd better learn a couple of texts, and if I say them often enough, I might believe them and then feel sure. But assurance doesn't come from learning texts, good though that may be. Assurance is something from within, which is produced by his Spirit. But if you quench his Spirit, you will have no assurance. If his Spirit takes over, you will have assurance. And you will know that you're a child of God. But also, you'll be living a life that is pleasing to him. The third minor point is this, that as other people look at you, they will see the reality of Jesus. And they won't know what it is, but they'll be curious. And as they ask themselves, how does this person live a life of this caliber? Then the Father will testify, that is my Son. That's Jesus. You're seeing Jesus in them. And your Christian witness will be effective, it will be powerful. Because God will add his seal of authority to what you do. And they won't be just human words. They will be backed by his stamp of authority. And people will be influenced by the caliber of your life. So if you just Ken Needham living, then the Father says, yuck. Other people say, is that supposed to be Christianity? Not for me. And I go around hoping that there really is a God and I really am right with him. If, on the other hand, the Spirit of Jesus is let loose and he's living, the Father says, hey, that's great. Other people are impressed with the reality of Jesus and drawn to him. And I know that I am his son and his servant. There is no doubt. There's a tremendous inner witness that I can't deny. So who's living today? Is it you or is it Jesus? I want you to be filled with the knowledge of his will so that you may live a life worthy of him who has called you, pleasing to him in every way. But the only person who ever pleased him is Jesus. Our Father, we thank you for Jesus Christ. We thank you for the wonder of the life that he lived that was so superior to anyone else, so different, so holy, and so joyful. So pure, and so rich and fulfilled. So strong and yet so loving. Lord, thank you for him. And thank you that he is the one who is going to live in me, even tonight, to please you. I know I can't live that kind of a life. And I wouldn't want you to pull down your standards to meet me. I thank you that in Jesus, you lift me to meet your standards. For his name's sake. Amen.